content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. It is underwritten by the law firm of Nair and Wenzel, PA, with offices in Raleigh and Smithfield, and by our friends Mary and David Stevens. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters. We are ably assisted by Missy Hollander as our engineer. Thank you, Missy. This is an original program produced in the Triangle Radio Reading Service studio, and for the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics to champion your legal rights so that you can obtain access and full participation in your community and achieve your goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on law supporting independent living. And in today's episode, I am very pleased to have a couple of my colleagues from Nair and Wenzel, PA, Jason Wenzel and Matt McGonigal. Guys, thank you very much for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Joe. Yes,
thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. Well, let's kick things off with Jason, since his name's on the door. Jason, tell us a little bit about yourself, your bio, and tell us a little bit about Nairn and Wenzel.
Sure. Jason Wenzel, I was originally from Jacksonville, Florida. Moved up during high school to the frozen tundra of Michigan before seeing the light and coming back down to North Carolina. For Wake Forest Law School, and I've been with the firm now since 2002. And recently, we've had some exciting news. The name changed effective November 1. Two of the original partners who started the firm back in the mid-70s as a natural progression as people tend to get older. And as we've grown, we opened our Raleigh office about 3 years ago. We now have about 11 lawyers between the two offices, and we're taking advantage of the growth that the Raleigh area has experienced, and we're excited to continue to serve not only our current clients, but many future clients in the years to come.
That's great. Well, thank you, Jason. And Matt, you're also from Florida, aren't you?
That's correct. I also grew up in Florida and kind of moved around a little bit all over growing up from Oklahoma to Florida, and went back to Oklahoma for law school, and have made it back to Florida, did a year of income tax training after law school, and worked down in Florida for a couple of years before moving up to North Carolina, seeing the light, as Jason says, and getting back up to God's country here, and been here since 2009 and worked for the firm since I've been up here, and it's been a great experience, and we're happy to have grown and expanded into our Raleigh presence. So it's a great situation for us.
Well, I'm excited to have you both on as guests of this program. I myself joined Nair and Wenzel, or its predecessor, about a year and a half ago, and it's been a very, very happy experience for me, and very glad to have you guys up here, and delighted that we've moved into a little bit larger space, and so everything's going very well for us here in Raleigh. So, well, Nair and Wenzel is, I would say, almost a full-service firm. We cover a wide range of legal issues. I know, Jason, you do a lot of real estate, and you do a lot of transactional work, and you represent small businesses. Tell us a little bit about your practice, Jason.
Yes, sir. Well, at least from the real estate side, you never really know when somebody calls up with a real estate issue what exactly they're asking about. But some of the things I wanted to touch on here today, I think that may be applicable to your listeners, would include the due diligence aspect before you get into whatever type of real estate venture you may be getting into, whether that's buying a home, leasing a property. That the old adage is caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. And I think oftentimes people get ahead of themselves. Either they're concerned, let's say, with the cost aspect of what that's going to be. But it is, frankly, one of the more important and larger financial decisions most people make. And you've always heard, in the construction business, right? You measure twice and you cut once. Well, I think that applies here as well, that whether that's getting a survey done before you buy a property, whether that's reviewing the covenants in a neighborhood before you decide to move in there, or at least having somebody take a second look at what you're about to spend an awful lot of time and years of your life paying on, whether that's a one-year lease or a 30-year mortgage. I really think it is something that I find a lot of people have gotten themselves into something it's a lot harder to get out of than it would have been to try to address it before they got into it.
Right. Well, speaking of due diligence, I know in the commercial world that there is a section of the Americans with Disabilities Act that applies to public accommodations, which you're not just talking about hotels and restaurants, but you're talking about businesses. There's a very big issue this time of year with Christmas shopping and everything, but making sure that your commercial real estate is ADA compliant, because and when you sell your commercial real estate, the buyer is going to have an interest in getting something that is ADA compliant. Any insights about that? I know that the ADA is something that people might take for granted, but anything that you can share with us about that?
Yes, it is. When you really look at the history of the laws in our country, the ADA is very new. Mm-hmm. It goes back to, help me on the date, 1990?
About that, 1993, somewhere in that,
so
early 90s.
If you think about that from how long we've had buildings in our country, North Carolina especially being a colony, there are a lot of buildings, public accommodation type buildings, Joe, as you mentioned, that may have been grandfathered in. They may think they're grandfathered in. And it really, from even the slightest change of use, depending on where they're located, what jurisdiction, either from a county or from a municipality or a town, a lot of different things can apply, that it goes back to that due diligence concept we were talking about. And certainly if any, both from a developer standpoint, you certainly want to get it right. I don't think I have really any clients that are really trying to find a way around things like that. Certainly we all live in the real world. They're mindful of the cost of it, but ignorance of the law is just no real good defense anymore. It doesn't mean people don't try it, but it goes back to knowing what you're doing before you do it and making sure you try to get it right on the front end.
Excellent. That's exactly right. So, Matt, first of all, you have got a master's in taxation, don't you?
That's correct. Yes, sir.
So Jason and I have JD degrees. And so does Matt, but Matt has also gone a step further and gotten an LLM in taxation. So that is your specialty, is it?
That is one of my specialties. That's right. And kind of the planning that goes around and involves that aspect of tax.
Right. So right. You do a lot of estate work and
reaches into estate planning and business planning and the like.
Talk to us a little bit about the intersection of disability law and what you do.
Sure. We get a lot of clients that come in and they've got either an adult child that may be qualified for benefits or grandchildren that may be qualified for benefits. And the common question is, well, what do I do with my assets as it pertains to them as a beneficiary of my estate? And so, you know, there's several options. Two main options, I think, for most people that come into those situations. One is doing some sort of special or supplemental needs trust within the client's plan, or kind of a newer creature that came out in 2015 is what's called an ABLE account. It's a acronym, you know, one of these acts that stands for Achieving a Better Life Experience. And it's an account that's akin to a 529 education account for specifically for people with a disability, and it allows for them to establish an account up to roughly $100,000 without jeopardizing their benefits. The individual themselves can contribute to it, or any other individuals can contribute to the account up to a maximum of $15,000 every year. And so it's a tax deferred account. So it can be used to pay for needs that are not met through your other benefits otherwise.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. That's a very interesting topic right there. I mean, what are the nuts and bolts of setting up an account like that?
Frankly, you've got to go online and set it up. But the basics are you have to have been declared disabled prior to reaching age 26, and then you've got to otherwise meet the definitions of being disabled for purposes of SSI. Mm-hmm. You don't actually have to have qualified for benefits, but you've got to meet the definition of it otherwise. And that's really the nuts and bolts of how to qualify. And then you just set up an account online and start making your contributions.
The disability aspect of it, people will be surprised many times under the Americans with Disabilities Act at the breadth of what disability is. The definition is very broad, and it's it just kind of cascades from there. But there are manifest handicaps. I mean, people who are visually impaired, people who are obviously quadriplegics or paraplegics, and would be disabled. Are there any gray areas for the ABLE account?
I think it's less restrictive. I think the basics that I understand it is, if you qualify for SSI or SSDI, mm-hmm. you are automatically able to open one of these accounts.
I see.
And then if you are not already qualified under those programs, you can still get one of these accounts if you otherwise meet the similar definitions of what is disabled to be able to qualify under those mm-hmm. programs. So I think that you're going to look at the requirements under those particular programs and figure out if you're able to qualify.
Right, yeah. Right. Now, you said you can go online and do this. Now, Jason and Matt and I are very prejudiced in favor of getting a lawyer anytime there is a legal issue. And certainly we LegalZoom and other right. big enterprises are coming in and trying to make it look right. easier.
When I say you go online, I literally mean you have to go online to set up the account, not that you should do it by yourself.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We definitely think legal assistance would be of benefit.
This should be done as part of an overall plan that may include using one of these going forward.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, take us from there. I mean, expound on the overall plan part of it.
This is an option as to where to put money in a tax advantage way.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be applicable in a case where a disabled person may be earning a little income, and it can contribute money to this as almost like a retirement account.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be as part of that for the individual themselves, or if people have money they want to gift to the individual and they can't, it may disqualify them under SSI or SSDI, this could be an option as a place to put the money for their benefit.
Mm-hmm.
The other avenue to go down is when you are planning your personal estate plan and you've got, like I said, a child or a grandchild that's otherwise qualified or maybe qualifying for benefits in the future, to build in some sort of special needs or supplemental needs trust within that document itself to provide for the items that are not otherwise taken care of under your SSI or Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be part of a plan where someone would come in and say, I've got these other people that are qualified. I don't want to give them the money because that would disqualify them under those programs. What can I do? And the answer is a supplemental needs trust.
Mm-hmm.
It limits the access for the disabled individual to the money, but provides the trustee a mechanism for providing that money for their care.
Right.
For the things that are not otherwise provided for. Things mm-hmm. like a wheelchair or transportation or not housing, but things that would go in a house that you would otherwise need. There's a various items that you can actually limit the trust to paying for.
Yeah, I'm picturing something like ERISA. Of course, it's totally different.
Right.
But the employer gets a tax benefit, a write-off, when the employer puts the money into an ERISA plan. And the beneficiary or the participant is able to get the money without tax consequences right then, and the tax is deferred until they start pulling the money down. I mean, is it something like that? Is there is there any benefit
for the ABLE account? That is exactly what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a tax deferred. It's not subject to tax up to a certain point. I have to look back at the rules on what that point is, but it has to do with what you're earning outside it and how much you're getting out of it and mm-hmm. what it's being used for. To the extent that it's used for the qualifying expenses, then it's not subject to tax. On the trust side, that may be a little different mm-hmm. ballgame, because trusts are subject to tax,
mm-hmm.
And so that may be a little bit more
right.
complicated
right.
at that point.
Matt, you mentioned a trust. What exactly is a trust?
A trust is, simply put, a designation for somebody to hold property for the benefit of another under the legal terms or the terms of the agreement that you set forth.
And who would the parties to a trust be?
The settlor or the grantor of a trust and the trustee, the person that's named as the person that will hold the assets on behalf of another, and then the beneficiaries, the people that the trust is set up for.
And there again, that is something that you do. You set up trusts.
Trusts every day.
Yeah, every day. So, and certain paperwork goes along with that and
right.
legal documentation. On the ABLE account, on the front end where the money goes in, if you're setting one of these up for a beneficiary, and you probably already said this, but is there a deduction to the person who sets it up, putting
it
the money in?
I do not know if North Carolina provides in and of itself, there is not a deduction. No.
Okay.
Yeah. Certain states have started trying to maybe give some sort of small incentive to putting money into these accounts, but in and of itself, there's not a deduction. No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is like a trust, because, I mean, you're taking after-tax dollars.
That's right. It's after-tax money. You put it in the account,
and
that grows tax-free going forward.
That's mm-hmm. right. Okay.
The benefit is that the individual that it's set up for can continue to hold money without disqualifying themselves for benefits otherwise.
So you get tax deferral, and you get it's not counted against you for your benefits, disability benefits, which is a huge issue.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. Well, anything else you can share with us about your tax practice and what we can...
In my practice, I think that there is a preconceived notion or a bad taste in your mouth when you hear about people trying to put money in a trust for the benefit of somebody that's otherwise on benefits, and the thinking being, well, you've got money, why don't you just pay for what they need? And I heard an interesting talk not too long ago that I thought I would share, is that, you know, a lot of those times, people that could otherwise pay for the services they need, it's not about the money. It's about the programs that they're qualified for because they are declared disabled and they're within the Medicaid program or the SSI program, that they would not otherwise be able to get if they weren't part of the program. And so a lot of these times, you know, whether it's a group home or something of that nature, a lot of these trusts can help you continue to qualify for those going forward. So it's not just about money and mooching off the government, I guess, so to speak. It's what's best for the individual and what do they need going forward, and how can this help you do that?
Very good. Well, Jason, have you discussion anything else come to you that you would like to contribute?
I would mention one thing, Joe, that many of my clients, especially when they may have been in a property for a long period of time, making payments, sometimes known as, you know, the old rent to own, so to speak, there used to be a concept known as an installment land contract. And what that would be is kind of you're making monthly payments, whether that's treated as rent or part of it's being treated as rent, but that after some period of time, 5 years, 10 years, even longer, that you've made your final payment and you get a deed. So you don't get the deed until you made all the payments. Well, over a period of time, life happens, right? You can lose a job, you can get sick, you've got to take care of a parent, and you miss one of those payments. Well, if under the terms of that installment land contract you had missed a payment, then normally those are very favorably written towards the owner of the property. They can declare you in default, and then you're out all those payments. You haven't built any equity, and you never get your deed. Well, again, a relatively recent change in the North Carolina statutes tried to discourage that former practice. And we now have a statute under Chapter 47H that says those are now called something known as a contract for deed. And if you have entered into one of those type agreements after 2010, there is a much more stringent set of disclosures that the owner has to give to you. They have to give you periodic statements on account. If the owner has mortgaged that property and they don't tell you that in bold and capitalized letters in that contract for deed agreement, you may have some ability to get out of that or to otherwise renegotiate that. And because of the harshness of those, in my experience, most courts, most judges look very disfavorably at an owner trying to strictly enforce that against somebody who has made payments for a long period of time. So back to your initial advice of if you find something yourself in a situation like that, talk to a lawyer. Talk to a second lawyer if you don't like what the first lawyer tells you. But it's something that you shouldn't just roll over on.
Mm-hmm. I will make a bit of a contribution myself. I typically don't talk too much about what I do, but I have been doing labor and employment law now for 40 years. And it's never a dull moment, never a dull moment.
You must have gotten your law degree at about age 10 then.
yeah. I delayed going to law school for a year and taught special education in Selma, North Carolina for 4 years. So that was a great experience. But we really did not, I've done a lot of workers' comp. So that is a certain type of disability law, but and certainly can be relevant to what we talk about on legal matters as well. But primarily, the laws that I deal with for disabled people are the Americans with Disabilities Act from the early 90s. And then another latecomer in that, the Family and Medical Leave Act. And so I deal with those issues on the both on the employer side, trying to counsel employers to follow the law and try to keep them on the straight and narrow and helping them out when issues do arise, but also helping individuals who are trying to secure their rights and perfect their rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the FMLA. And so they came into effect after I'd been practicing law for well over a decade. And so, lawyers are looking the other way when new laws come get handed down. And you put it off on younger lawyers. But I ended up with that being something that I had to work into my program of work. Just a war story. I got into labor and employment law very early in my career. Was within a month. One of the older partners came into my office and said, Joe, there's some gentlemen downstairs that think they've got an age discrimination case. And he says, he looks at me and says, a young man's got to start somewhere. So I ended up a month into my practice dealing with the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. And my senior partner at the time, Troy Smith, was infamous for if you handled one kind of case, then you were the expert after that. So that's how I got my start into employment law, and it's been very interesting ever since. So I'm very glad to join Naren and Wenzel. It was Naren O'Hale and Whittington before that. Jason, you've had a great relationship with the other guy whose name's on the door, Jimmy Naren. We'd be remiss not to say a little bit about Jimmy in this program. We've got a few seconds here. Tell us a little bit about your experience with him. He's kind of been your mentor, hasn't he?
He has, and he is very well respected throughout, not just our state's bar, but really other states as well. And one thing I would say about him is that he is always, whether it's somebody in our firm or otherwise, he was an adjunct professor at Campbell for a number of years teaching law. I think he still has that professor mentality, that he is a student of the law, still is in there on weekends, still reading law review articles, still writing papers. And I really think that has trickled down to the culture of where we work. One last thing I'll mention, just as a informational piece to the listeners, talking about laws that constantly can and do change, that the power of attorney statutes in our state changed fairly significantly as of January 1 of 2018. And so what a power of attorney is essentially appointing somebody else to make some decisions for you, either from a healthcare standpoint or from a financial standpoint. And so if you don't have one of those, that's something that you might need to have. And if you haven't updated it in a number of years, that may be something you want to look at.
Great. Thank you, Jason. That's a good point for us to say that we've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. And we want you to tune in next time. It's the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 7 a.m. We hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about your legal rights and about obtaining equal access and full participation in your community. I want to thank Jason Wenzel and Matt McGonigal of Jason Wenzel PA for joining me today. Thank you, guys. We're going to have you back. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138. And again, we've been underwritten today by the law firm of Naren Wenzel PA and by our friends Mary and David Stevens.